It's out there. We don't have to turn around and discover it now. Every good enough mother teaches her child that no matter how bad it seems, no matter how many rejections or scraped knees or broken bones there are, it's going to be okay. Maybe not the way we wanted or hoped it would be, but still okay. A good parent returns a child to the place where she can trust that although she might be bitter or hateful for a moment, it's not the end of the world. There is love here. There is light and quiet here. There is peace. At some point, it looks like this is it, therapy meets spirituality, and fixing ourselves meets the realization that there is nothing more to fix. There are always going to be challenges in this dimension of body personality. Plane flights will be missed, people will reject me, and whatever thrilled me last year will disappoint me this year. Just when I think I've got it all together, an earthquake occurs, someone dies, I get ill. When I take myself to be the sum of what happened to me as a child or is happening at this very moment, I can never get it right for very long. When I take myself to be the unending, always forgiving space in which the drama is unfolding, I am already always fine. Finally, we have to fall on the sword of knowing what we know and stop pretending that we don't know it. Until that moment, and I seem to be a slow learner because it took decades of therapy and spiritual practice to get me here, we act like children who are stuck on the wrong planet, in the wrong bodies, with the wrong families, and we spend our time searching for more, better, loving parents and ever more creative, addictive ways out. And when we forget, we can gently remind ourselves that even that from which we want to be saved, most of all, death itself, is just closing our eyes. Part 3. Into the Sublime. Chapter 15. A Big Quiet. When Eckhart Tolle invited me to film a conversation with him for his television series, I was honored but didn't want to go. The filming was scheduled for December in Vancouver. Rainy, cold, snowy when it isn't rainy Vancouver. I'd read The Power of Now in 1999 when it was first published and liked it enough to buy a copy for a friend who gave it back to me because she didn't understand it or him or why anyone would want to. And I'd been to a workshop with Eckhart at Esalen in 2000. It was in a crowded outdoor tent. And the friends with whom I went, the ones who would soon file for divorce, bickered incessantly. Of seeing Eckhart Tolle for the first time, I only remember brief flashes. The numinous light reflected from the walls of the tent on the odd-looking man with big ears at the podium. The wave in his hair, his hard-to-place accent. I don't remember what he said or how I felt about what he said. More memorable was that my friend, the wife of the bickering couple, got sick from the spicy garlic eggplant at Saturday's dinner, and we left before the last session. At the time of the phone call from Eckhart's office, more than a decade had elapsed since I'd attended that workshop, and Eckhart had become famous as a spiritual teacher. Still, I remembered his history. He'd been an anxious, depressed, Cambridge-educated intellectual who one night at the age of 29 reached a nadir of suffering, after which he had a shift, his words, into irrevocable peace and stillness. And after rereading The Power of Now, I remembered what I was so taken with years before, the fact that he said with absolute certainty that it was possible to be in a human body and be truly at ease, and not because of anything you had, did, or looked like. It's not that I hadn't had experiences of this ease. I'd lived at an ashram in India in the 70s, attended meditation retreats in the 80s, and had been part of an ongoing spiritual inquiry group for 2 decades. During the past 36 years, I'd spend weeks at a time feeling as if nothing was missing. Each time the experience was like breathing in fresh oxygen after being trapped in an airless underground room for what seemed like centuries. Like popping out of a bad dream into a palace of starlight. But those glimpses were fleeting, even the ones that lasted a few months, and most of them were brought on by long retreats or catastrophes. Within a few post-retreat or disaster months, I'd return to ricocheting between bouts of self-doubt and wanting the next more. Since I'd been banging my head against the wall of discontent for a few decades, I figured it might be helpful to converse with someone who had already stopped. So after deciding on the essentials, what I was going to wear, black dress, motorcycle boots, I flew off to Vancouver. From the outside, Eckhart looked like any other person, trending toward the unusual. His eyes were set far apart, he had a slight hump on his back, and he walked with a slow sway. He wore a teal blue sweater vest, not exactly fashion forward, that reminded me of my 8th grade algebra teacher, Mr. Deloria, with his bow ties and cable knit vests. But it wasn't Eckhart's vest or walk or clear violet eyes that were remarkable. It was the feeling of being with a human sky. After hugging me, he regarded me with a combination of curiosity, warmth, and lack of pretense, as if to say, "So, here you are." And the immediate effect it had on me was that I didn't feel awkward or not enough or dumb. I wasn't even aware of myself in the usual way. It was as if I'd been living inside a machine and had gotten so used to the drone of the engine that I'd forgotten that it was on. With him, only a big quiet remained. One of the first things Eckhart asked me, after he mentioned he'd read my books and liked them very much, was what I was going to write about when I wasn't neurotic anymore. When you are through writing about the trauma and abuse and addiction you've lived through, what then? He asked. I wanted to say, what makes you think there will come a time when I won't be neurotic or crazy? I wanted to say, one needs to suffer to create. What about Fitzgerald, Hemingway, and Van Gogh? But the question so surprised me. No one had ever presupposed there would come a time when I wouldn't be neurotic, that all I could mumble was, gee, I have no idea. Because, in fact, I didn't. At dinner the first night, I watched his movements, listened to the cadence of his voice. He was deceptively ordinary and extraordinarily calm. He liked red wine, Nikes, and wind-up watches. But being with him was so challenging to what I called normal, i.e., being acquisitive, never having enough, defining myself by what I did, that it was like having dinner with someone from another star system. The waitress, a woman with bright red hair and a nose ring, asked me what I wanted. I answered that I'd like the broiled salmon with broccoli and a glass of Malbec wine, but what I really wanted to say, having just seen When Harry Met Sally for the umpteenth time, was that I wanted what Eckhart had. Then I decided, having only just met him, that even an oblique reference to orgasms might not be the best idea. Since my early 20s, I'd been haunted by the specter of getting to the end of my life without having fully lived, although I didn't know what that meant. Traveling to far-flung and unspoiled places like Antarctica, the Amazon, the Galapagos, adopting a foster child, learning to skydive. But within a few months of meeting Eckhart, I began to understand that the question wasn't what I did, it was how. And it wasn't about adding more big experiences. I'd had plenty of those already. I didn't wash my right hand for 2 days after it shook Nelson Mandela's. It was about showing up day to day. Was I actually present when I answered emails, planted strawberries, or listened to Matt tell me about his day? Or was I careening around in my mind, fantasizing about the future, revisiting the past, wanting to get done with what I was doing so that I could get on to the next better thing? Since the answer was anywhere but here, I decided to follow two of Eckhart's suggestions for 30 days. I figured that if careening was really better than showing up, i.e. breathing when I breathed, walking when I walked, I could easily go back to my old ways. My first practice was to stop complaining. When my office manager forgot to send out an email that invited people to an event I was teaching, I set up a different reminder system, but I didn't complain. When my bank account was hacked and I discovered someone was stealing money from it daily, I reported it to the bank and closed my account, but wouldn't allow myself to complain. When I found a mouse sitting next to me on the arm of my favorite chair, I screamed and ran out of the house, but did not complain. Then, for anyone who might be interested, I walked back into the house, trapped it underneath an empty cottage cheese container, and brought it outside, still screaming the entire time. Is a scream a complaint? But it wasn't just extreme situations. I stopped complaining to anyone about anything. I kept reminding myself of what I'd heard years ago, that complaining about what has already happened is like eating rat poison and waiting for the rat to die. I soon realized, it took about 10 minutes, that what I called conversations were at least partially a litany of complaints about who done me wrong, and an attempt to elicit outraged murmurs of agreement. Without shoring up the me that this shouldn't have happened to, but always sigh, sigh, sigh did, I wasn't sure what to talk about. Could anyone actually live without complaining? Did Eckhart? I wanted to write and ask him, but that seemed like a backdoor complaint about how hard it was not to complain, so I decided against it. Matt and I would get in the car and I'd open my mouth to say, "Can you believe what Una did today?" But the words would catch in my throat like chicken bones. And I'd ask about his day, or I'd open the window and look at the trees. Since I didn't tell Matt about my new resolve, and since I was unusually quiet, he kept asking me if I was ill. When your lifelong partner is concerned you have the flu if you stop complaining, it's a bit sobering. My second practice was to be conscious of one entire breath, 5 or 6 times a day, for 1 minute. Since I was already breathing, it didn't seem like a stretch to put my attention on the beginning, middle, and end of a breath. To notice how it seemed to start in my belly, work its way up to my heart, throat, head, and back. After daily meditations in which I'd follow my breath for 45 minutes, noticing 5 measly breaths a few times a day seemed like a cinch. As the days passed, I noticed that I'd be walking in the forest, and instead of noticing the wild pale yellow orchids, I'd be thinking about dinner that night. I'd be walking to the kitchen, and instead of feeling the movement of one leg and then another, I'd be thinking about the radiation from Fukushima, or whether the honeybees were going to become extinct, and if apples would still be around in 10 years. It didn't take long before I realized why I was perpetually haunted by a fear of missing my life. I already was. The very act of noticing how much I wanted to complain or how far into my thoughts I'd wandered pierced the familiar trance I'd called my life. I started noticing what I'd been missing. The first sip of tea, the barely perceptible lift of the wind on my face. Each time I refrained from complaining or noticed the full range of breath, I was startled by the vividness of what was in front of me, even if I'd seen it 1,000 times before. A chandelier, a strawberry, my husband. Be like a child, the Tibetan Buddhists say, astonished at everything. For a few times a day, every day, I felt like a child and understood for the billionth time that we become what we spend our time on. When I spend my time complaining, I find more and more to complain about and become an altakaka, as they say in Yiddish. Translation, a cantankerous old fart. There are months now when I am definitely not my same old cantankerous self, and everything seems to be made of a kind of fizzing light, arms, legs, banana slugs, garbage. On those days, I feel like Dustin Hoffman in Tootsie, whose character has been impersonating a female soap opera star. He turns to his paramour, Jessica Lange, and says, "I was a better man with you as a woman than I ever was with a woman as a man. I am a better me as not me than I ever was as me." Then there are the other days, the slog days. I wake up grumpy and within 30 seconds enter the rat maze of my thoughts. It's almost as if the spaciousness has suddenly become unnerving, as if I've convinced myself that although I was dumb enough to drink the Kool-Aid of believing that freedom from suffering was possible, I'm over it now and can get back to the comfort of feeling grumpy, rejected, and worthless. It reminds me of my students who, after spending 7 blissful days on retreat in which food was not a problem, get home and are furious with me because they fell for the possibility that their whole lives could be like that. On those days, I feel trapped in a familiar underground room, and it takes a while to return to life above ground. But when I pop back into the stillness, it always feels the same, as if I've just been dreaming myself, and I'm now awake. And each time, the sweetness and stillness of return feel more and more like home. Chapter 16, The Breaths I Have Left. When I was 8, my father gave me a copy of Death Be Not Proud, a book by John Gunther about the life and death of his son Johnny. And by the time I turned the last page, and I say this in the kindest possible way, I'd become a bit of a hypochondriac and completely death-obsessed. Not only did I start worrying that every time I got a headache, I had a brain tumor, as little Johnny did, but I also became convinced that the end was near. When my parents walked out the door, I wondered whether I would see them again. When my brother went to Mike May day camp, I worried he would get run over by a car. I just couldn't believe that 8-year-old Johnny had died and that everyone else would die as well. It didn't seem fair. It didn't seem right. Or as Woody Allen said when asked how he felt about death, "I am strongly against it." In my 20s and 30s, I elevated my death obsession into a spiritual practice. I learned Buddhist meditation, went to graveyards with teachers who were intent on teaching us what I'd known for years. Life is short. People die. You will be amongst them. I traveled to India and saw the burning ghats in Benares. I witnessed how long it took a body, with all its bones and muscle, hair and eyes, to turn to ashes. FYI, a long time. I had to get a Coke halfway through and come back for the rest. I learned a lot from spiritual practice about ease and loveliness and my crazy mind, but it didn't dispel my fears of death. If anything, it exacerbated them because I became more aware of the shortness of life, my life in particular. There is an old saying in Buddhist circles that this human life is so precious that it is as if each one of us is like a turtle that lives in the ocean and comes up for air every 100 years. If by chance that rising turtle puts his head through a bucket floating on the ocean surface, it would be extremely rare. Attaining a human life is even rarer than that. So since you have a chance in this one precious life to discover who you really are, your true nature, don't waste a single second. Talk about pressure. As I headed into my 40s and 50s, people around me were dying or had died. My father, my dear friend Lou, my cat, my Aunt Bee, my friend Rosemary, and every time it was the same. How could a person, even those with four legs, be here one day and gone the next? Death was so irreversible, so forever, unlike, say, buying a pair of shoes from Zappos with a 365-day return policy. But then something unexpected happened. During a routine medical procedure, my throat closed, my heart rate skyrocketed, my blood pressure dropped, and I had the strange sensation of leaving my body. I was conscious enough to realize that this was the big it. I was dying. I remember being surprised that it was happening so quickly and on an ordinary day in September. I was hoping for harps and orchids and long, soulful glances of loved ones when I died, not a chilly, antiseptic examination room with a nurse with a purple happy face pinned on her smock and a doctor with a wandering eye who kept imploring me to look at him. Although there were many compelling insights during and after that near-death experience, one that has remained with me is the visceral understanding that all my years of being death-obsessed weren't actually about dying or death, they were about life. They weren't about fear of the end, they were about longing to be awake in the middle, also known as the present. I wanted, as the poet Mary Oliver says, to spend my life married to amazement, not wedded to regret or exhaustion. After the medical procedure, I realized that this life was not a dress rehearsal for some bigger, better promise around the corner. This was it, and my breaths were numbered. I didn't know how many breaths I had left. An 80-year-old person takes about 672,768,000 breaths in a lifetime, which meant I'd used up three-quarters of my allotted breaths. But it became apparent that no matter how charming I was or how many organic pomegranates I ate, not dying was not an option. Within a few days of being home from the hospital, I made a list of what I loved, of what I would have regretted not doing more of had I died in the examination room. The list was short. Being with my husband, family, and friends, playing with my dog, being outside, writing and teaching. I began quitting things in which I didn't want to participate. I began saying no to parties I didn't want to go to, invitations I didn't want to accept. I quit a graduate program in which I was enrolled, and I started working on a book I'd wanted to write for years. I spent more time with trees, particularly a maple tree in our driveway. I told my husband regularly what I cherished about him and our life together. Over and over, with each day and each choice, I asked myself, is this something on which I want to spend the breaths I have left? 8 years have passed, and I am still asking that question. Not always, of course. Sometimes when my husband and I are fighting, revenge supplants breaths in my mind. But even then, I frequently pull myself back from the brink and remember that we are only alive for a brief run, and I don't want to miss a breath. Chapter 17, Waiting for the Apocalypse. Since childhood, I've been enthralled by disaster scenarios and fantasies of what I would do and where I would go when things got too terrible to stay. I'm not sure if it was knowing that a few dozen relatives were killed in Auschwitz because they didn't leave Germany in time, or that living with my abjectly miserable with each other parents unhinged my nervous system, but I lived in anticipation of the next cataclysmic shoe to drop. I ran away twice, once when I was 8 and got as far as the end of the block before my Uncle Murray saw me, asked where I was going with my pink flowered suitcase, and coaxed me back with the promise of Hostess cupcakes with white squiggles on top. Even then, the lure of cupcakes trumped my best intentions. The second time I ran away, I was 16 and made it as far as a hotel in Manhattan. Being a stowaway on a train wasn't my style, but since I was using my mother's credit card, I wasn't exactly hard to find. As I walked into the hotel room, my mother called and said, "Get home this instant." And that was that. Regardless of any tilt toward catastrophe, however, the truth remains that on any ordinary day, multiple unanticipated disasters are lurking. Car and bicycle accidents, a sudden heart attack while on an airplane or treadmill, someone we know or love getting run over by a drunk driver. Add to that the danger of falling in the bathroom, hitting one's head and getting a brain injury, and it's a miracle that any of us get out of bed in the morning. Still, despite the incipient terrors of living in this vulnerable human body, most of us manage rather well by engaging two highly effective defense mechanisms, denial and repression. We keep having babies, making plans for the future, living as if death only happens to other people. We push scary scenarios out of our minds. Enter climate science. My friend Lorraine reels off another climate science fact every time we talk. 100 kinds of plants and animals are going extinct every day. Honeybee colonies are collapsing. Shelves of Arctic glaciers are crashing into the ocean at a much faster rate than anyone ever imagined. Lorraine thinks that the people who are dying now of cancer, Parkinson's, and Alzheimer's are the lucky ones. They are dying with people they love around them. The rest of us will be dying long, drawn-out, horrific, climate-related deaths, she says. Lorraine implores me to move to Australia, where she lives, because at least no one will nuke Australia. It's not important enough. Also, the weather is beautiful, and although climate change will also wreak its havoc here, you'll most likely have a few more months to live than if you stay in California. What about all those spiders and snakes and sharks, I ask, reeling off what I know about Australia's poisonous creatures from a website I recently discovered. Australia is home to the 10 deadliest animals in the world. All of those animals, says this website, want you dead. There is a reason Australia is surrounded by nothing but water. God is trying to protect you from the hell trapped within. Even Bill Bryson, one of my favorite authors, wrote about the fact that all of the most poisonous creatures on earth live in Australia, while also proclaiming that he loved the country itself. As susceptible as I am to disaster scenarios, I know that making decisions from fear is a terrible idea. I tell Lorraine the story of my friend Sally's next-door neighbor who moved to higher ground during the 1982 mudslides in Santa Cruz and within 24 hours was dead from her safer house collapsing while the house from which she moved still stood. Isn't it conceivable, I asked Lorraine, that Matt and I could move to Australia for safety's sake and die within days from a poisonous snake bite? I suppose it is, she answers, but at some point you make a decision based on probabilities. To educate myself about probabilities, I read Bill McKibben's The End of Nature, Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything, and David Suzuki's The Sacred Balance, as well as dozens of articles by concerned scientists, including one by Yale University scientist Wei Lu, who warns that the collapse of a vital Atlantic Ocean current would create an ice age for the Northern Hemisphere. And while there are people, Naomi Klein is among them, who are still hopeful we can turn this ship around, the trajectory of history and corporate greed is not in the Earth's favor. We're in a giant car headed towards a brick wall, and everyone is arguing where they're going to sit, says David Suzuki. For years, I tried and failed miserably at being an activist, but the more marches and meetings I attended, the more enraged I became, and the more my stance became one of us and them, which was the very same as that of the oil companies and polluters. Although I don't exactly know what actions to take now, I am certain that stoking hatred will make me bitter and even more obstreperous than I already am. I also know from years of working with addiction that being against what's apparently wrong is less effective than being for what isn't. But that doesn't cut the loop of the catastrophic thinking or the intense desire to repress it all by distracting myself with pretty things to see or wear or eat. My friend Jeff says, every time the world around me gets too dark, I think, time to plan a trip to an exciting place. He's been to all 7 continents and 5 oceans many times, and is now about to visit the Amazon to swim with the pink dolphins. Would you and Matt like to come? He asks. The thought of swimming in the Amazon brings back memories of the multiple times I've contracted amoebic dysentery from doing exotic things like swimming in the Amazon, and I politely decline. But that leaves me alternately pretending that life as we know it has not changed, and convinced that since we will all be dead in 10 years, I might as well drink tequila before the agave plant becomes extinct, and eat chocolate before the cacao bean vanishes. And yet, I don't know anyone in my community who wants to discuss the end of days. I feel like a mad doomsday hysteric, until I remember that according to Bart Ehrman, a religious scholar, Jesus was a doomsday prophet. This comforts me immensely, not only because that was more than 2,000 years ago and we are still here, but also because if someone as illuminated as Jesus believed in the apocalypse, I figure I'm in good company. Given that a nuclear bomb has not yet hit, and there still seem to be at least a few more years of the emerald sweetness of life here on Earth, the question becomes, what to do now? Do I talk about climate science with my friends, despite their not wanting to hear? Do I walk around in a tempest of grief and anxiety, distract myself with exotic trips like swimming with pink dolphins in the Amazon, continue to sign petitions, give money to animal and earth causes? Is that enough? If this is truly the end of days, what would I do or say differently from what I am doing and saying now? As I become curious rather than reactive about my catastrophic tilt, I see that at its core is a frightened ghost child living in a family in which each day felt like the end of days. Anticipating the next worst thing colored every breath, every interaction, every meal. As soon as I allow myself to name and feel the imprint of that conditioning, kindness emerges for the child, the parents, and the situation itself, and the madness unwinds, since I am no longer either identified with the hysteria or fighting against it. There is awe here as well. For the mist drifting above the tree line outside my window, for the one brave rose left in my winter garden, for the water falling from the sky. When I acknowledge that there really is a chance that we may not have much longer on this earth, It forces me into unspeakable gratitude for being given this much time, or any time at all. Fear and anxiety are replaced by grief for the damage we've wrought and a resolve to do what I can to protect what remains. 30 years ago, I read a Ram Dass quote that I've never been able to locate. This is a paraphrase. Whether we're sailing into the new age or headed toward Armageddon, our work is exactly the same: to quiet the drums of fear, speak from a soft heart, and act from our shared humanity. Yes. Yes. Chapter 18. What Isn't Wrong? The rain in the south of France that summer was relentless. My feet were never dry, and because I had packed as if I was going to the Riviera instead of a month-long retreat in a moldy brown tent at Thich Nhat Hanh's Plum Village Center, I didn't have a raincoat. Morning meditations at 6 a.m. were cold, wet, and clammy. Evening meditations were waterlogged and frosty. Although I was supposed to be focusing on my breath or listening to a talk about the seven heaven realms, I was convinced I was trapped in a clammy Buddhist hellhole. One sodden morning, Thich Nhat Hanh changed topics from Buddhist sutras to toothaches. "How many of you don't have a toothache right now?" he asked. I can't remember whether everyone raised their hands, but there was definitely a quorum of non-toothache candidates in the room. Then he said, "When we have a toothache, all we can think about is going to the dentist or taking medication to stop the pain. But when we don't have a toothache, we don't appreciate the many benefits of the non-toothache state. So please turn to one of your brother or sister Sangha members and take 5 minutes to appreciate the state of not a toothache." And just like that, as I listed all the things that weren't wet and didn't hurt or ache, I noticed myself feeling light and undeniably happy. It was still raining and my feet were still damp, but my attention was no longer a constellation of what was wrong. Once again, I realized it wasn't the dampness, it's never the dampness, and that doesn't mean I would choose to wear wet shoes or go back to Plum Village. Dampness isn't miserable, it's just dampness. That's it. That's all. At its most basic, meditation is about watching thoughts without identifying with them, i.e. taking yourself to be them. You notice the mind activity itself and that you have a choice, you've always had a choice, about where to direct your attention. You can engage with the content of your thoughts, like "I am going to get pneumonia if I stay wet like this for one more second," or you can notice what isn't wrong, the fact that you are still breathing, a bird is chirping, you are still above ground. You can break the trance by using the senses: seeing color, hearing the scrape of a pen across the page, smelling the air when it rains. You can come back to what you've always had, what's always been here, and in T.S. Eliot's words, know the place for the first time. My friend Kate, who has spent 5 years undergoing one grueling chemotherapy treatment after another, as well as their attendant exhaustion, hope, disappointment, and discomfort, and has decided to stop all treatment, said, "It's taken me so long to realize that just being able to walk around TJ Maxx and buy a black tote with outside pockets makes me indescribably happy. I've been so pitched to the future, to when or if I get well, that I've missed so many walks, sounds, and totes. In the name of extending my life for 5 or 10 years, I've missed the one I've had." When we think a meaningful life is about grander things than being able to walk around TJ Maxx, we miss the joy of being able to walk at all. When we're convinced we have to earn joy, we don't notice the 10,000 places in which it is already waiting, asking, waving for our attention. After so many years of so many practices and so many prayers, I have only one left. Let me remember to pay attention to the ordinary, not just to the extraordinary, to finding the perfect tote with outside pockets, and to the sound of my feet walking click, click, click as I do. Chapter 19, The Blue Vest. We saw it in the window of a store on a side street in San Francisco, the piece of clothing for which I'd been waiting without knowing I'd been waiting. "Come and be enthralled," it whispered. "Let my fringes anoint you." I slipped into the floor-length vest like a swan would slip into her wings, and I glided around the room as if the store was my lake. As I passed the rows of jackets and racks of shoes, I felt like Harry Potter in his invisibility cloak, except that mine was made of manifest blue enchantment. "Do you like it?" I asked my husband when I emerged from the swoon. Although Matt's wardrobe consists mainly of rugby shirts, khaki pants, and New Balance shoes in various stages of wear, he has uncanny wisdom when it comes to women's sartorial plumage. "Where might you wear this?" he asked, eyeing the shimmering blue fabric. "It doesn't seem appropriate to wear around the house or to Whole Foods." "Oh, yeah," I thought, "that's right. We live in the country down a mile-long gravel road where our daily companions are owls, oak trees, and deer." When I thought about flouncing around on gravel in a silky vest, it broke the spell. I felt like my student Gloria, who said that when she eats a piece of chocolate, she feels like Cinderella becoming a princess. But when the chocolate is gone, she feels like a pauper again. I told Scott, the salesperson, we were now on a first-name basis, that although I really did like the vest and was surprised my husband didn't have to don his sunglasses to tolerate its blinding beauty, I'd call in a few days to see if it was still there. At dinner with friends that night, the conversation was lively, but visions of blue distracted me. The way the vest pulled around my legs, changed colors, became indigo, then cobalt, then slate. Wearing it is like wearing the ocean, I thought, as I took a bite of Caesar salad. And although it's true, I can't wear it to plant radishes in the garden. I have to wear something to restaurants or lectures. Why not this? The next morning, I decided to buy the vest. But as I started walking to the phone, the fight with myself began. I want to be the kind of person who was no longer enchanted by things. If I was born in Asia, I'd be a wise elder wearing plain blue cotton shirts and long gray braids. I'd be doing Tai Chi outside in town squares, playing checkers and consorting with other braided women about how best to handle the rabble-rousing young hellions. I need to meditate more, disengage from my thoughts, not buy more clothes. Because when I am on my deathbed, which is closer now than it was last year or the year before, having a blue vest won't matter, and I want to spend my energy on what does. As I skulked to the bathroom, I decided that I really was hopeless, a spiritual failure. Then, as I was brushing my teeth, I thought, but in that case, why not be hopeless in a blue vest? It shouldn't be a conundrum, but it is. I shouldn't love things, but I do. Although I am well aware that you become what you love, as the Sufis say, I don't seem to be able to help being who I am or loving what I love, especially beauty in its myriad forms, the dazzle of first morning light, my motorcycle boots with the red rhinestone boot belt, Matt's face, a blue vest. To the extent that there is a quandary, it is with my belief that beauty is defined by its forms, particularly those that are young and dewy-faced, or silky and impractical. As a teenager, after reading hundreds of glamour magazines, I was convinced that the antidote to feeling ugly was to become an actress or a model and be seen as being beautiful. In eighth grade, I told my classmates I'd been cast as an orphan in the Broadway show Oliver, in which Bartley Larson, one of our friends, was already starring. Unfortunately, since the whole class was given season tickets to the show and I never appeared in it, they discovered that I had an elastic relationship with the truth. In 10th grade, I played the role of an ailing debutante in a skit opposite my real-life heartthrob, Martin Howard, and bombed so completely, I had a hard enough time being myself. Being someone else was impossible. That in the auditorium of a few hundred people, only my mother clapped when I took my bow. Undeterred in my attempts to mesmerize people, I decided to become a model. Wearing a white A-line dress with pale blue lines and looking like a well-outfitted tent, I renamed myself Janine Howard, dragged my brother to the Barbizon School in Manhattan, and presented myself to the receptionist. She asked me to get on the scale. I weighed 110 pounds. Told me I was too fat and that my legs were too short. When it became obvious that a trend of 5'3", stubby-legged models would not begin with me, I narrowed my focus to keeping my skin smooth, my muscles toned, and my hair shiny in hopes of approximating a culturally acceptable version of attractive. It worked, until it didn't. At 30, I looked like I was in high school. At 45 or 50, I looked like I was 30. But at 65, I could walk down the street with my hair on fire, as my friend Catherine says, and no one would notice. Although I still feel youngish, and that everyone my age is an adult, whereas I am merely in disguise, as Margaret Atwood puts it, I am still somewhat shocked when I ask for a senior discount at the movie theater and there is no protest. If I see a friend for the first time in a few years, I wonder whether he's had a stroke or is dying because he looks so diminished. And then I realize that he's probably wondering the same about me. At first I was confused by getting older. Why can't I read the small print? Then offended. For God's sakes, who on earth could read this? And finally, I surrendered. Progressive lenses, I decided, were eye jewelry. Cool. But just when I thought I'd reached an aging plateau, my chin disappeared into my neck, and I started looking like my jowly father when he was dying. My arms soon followed. They began looking speckled, like I'd just taken off a polka dot sweater. Who even knew that arm cellulite existed? And every morning there were more lines around my eyes and my mouth, although because I couldn't see without my glasses, I wasn't certain. Despite the fact that everyone who doesn't die young gets old, I must have believed that getting older was a choice. And since I wasn't making it, it wouldn't happen to me. And until recently, except for the eye jewelry, I haven't been a model of aging with grace. Just as I used to stand in front of the mirror and pull back the fat on my thighs to see what they would look like if I lost 20 pounds, I pull back what Anne Lamott calls the Utah desert on my neck to see what I would look like without it. It's as if I fantasize that looking younger will give something back to me that I lost, besides my chin. or that there's only one way to see the lines around my eyes or the folds above them, as traitors to be vanquished. Since I've ruled out plastic surgery for many reasons, death by anesthetic, threats of divorce, feeling as if my head is in a tourniquet post-facelift, I am left with either fighting the ever-increasing effects of having lived this long or taking time out to reconsider the meaning of beauty. Years ago, my teacher Jean told me to think of my eyes as catcher's mitts. See what's there, she said, and allow yourself to take it in. Be filled by what you see. Which reminded me of what the novelist Albert Kosary wrote. So much beauty, so few eyes to see it. Could it be that beauty is about seeing and not about being seen? And that though a particular form is the transport mechanism, the way that bread is the delivery system for butter, it is the effect of beauty, the rapture of it, that actually elevates and inspires. And while it's true that I had moments of rapture when I was acceptably attractive, I also had months of melancholy. My well-defined neck and butt were not causative in either the rapture or the melancholy. The only thing, and I've traveled the earth looking, that has brought me ever-present joy is to see what I see, wake myself to the splendor in small things, and appreciate, appreciate, appreciate. Which brings me back to you know what. It is rather striking, Matt said, when I opened the UPS package in which the blue vest was nested. And when you wear it, you can quote Liberace and say, I didn't come here to go unnoticed. I reminded myself that Matt has many fine qualities. Humor, generosity, a heart as wide as the Grand Canyon, and that in our 29 years together, he has stopped me from looking like a shrub and a bear, but that he's not always right. Sometimes he misses the point of adornment for the joy of it, which is, in my opinion, one of the splendors of having a body. And since that body comes with a multitude of challenges, it's important to revel in the available joys. The ancient philosopher Plotinus said, beauty must ever induce a wonderment and a delicious trouble, a trembling that is all delight. Now, instead of pulling back the skin on my neck, I wear the blue ocean to buy zucchini at the store. I go to parties, and when everyone else is wearing t-shirts and jeans, I'm dressed in blue enchantment, awash in delight. Chapter 20, Not Minding What Happens. When I was in Ojai, California last year, I visited the home of Krishnamurti, the philosopher who died in 1986. I sat in the room in which he ate, walked the land on which he walked, and meditated under his favorite tree. I was hoping I would see what he saw, feel what he felt, know what he knew. I was hoping for enlightenment by osmosis. In Krishnamurti's notebook, a book of his journal writings, he describes the delicacy of a rosebush planted in a container on a corner of a deck in Paris. I was struck by the fact that although he was in the city that housed Monet's water lilies, Rodin's sculpture garden, and chocolate croissants, Krishnamurti dared to attend to the smallest beauty, and that often when he did, the otherness would arise. And it was so huge, so encompassing, that it dissolved everything we usually think of as a person, thoughts, emotions, beliefs. He wasn't frightened of it. He didn't fight it. He didn't conjure up, say, his relationship with his mother, so that he could become his familiar self and climb back into the shape of his personality as he knew it. I've had glimpses of this otherness, One of them occurred yesterday when I was sitting in my backyard. My mind was burbling on like an all-news radio station about my friend Mo, who was supposed to call me back and didn't. The fact that I needed to call the guys who pump out the septic tank because it's been too long, the emails that were piling up, and the dream I'd had the night before about meeting Patty Smith in front of a taco food truck. Then, in an effort that felt like chewing nails, I pulled my attention from the noise machine of my mind to the sun on my legs, the smell of sky, and the rustling of leaves in the wind. In the next moment, the person I usually knew as myself wasn't there, but something else was. And it was huge and lush, utterly still, and completely at ease. Thoughts were flying by in the background, but since I wasn't involved with them, they disappeared without a trace. Then I remembered the septic tank, and my usual sense of self, rushed, slightly irritated, sprang like a slinky into its tightly coiled form. And with the onrush of thoughts, I noticed an almost imperceptible relief, like the feeling of being able to speak in English after I've spent a week in Mexico, reaching for the Spanish words for bathroom, bank, and bed. Home at last. Krishnamurti writes, "Woke up in the middle of the night with the otherness in the room. It was there with great intensity, not only filling the room and beyond, but deep down within the brain, so profoundly that it seemed to go through and beyond all thought, space, and time. Strangely, every time this takes place, it's something totally new, unexpected, and sudden, beyond all thought, desire, and imagination. It's not an illusion." One night, someone in an audience of a few hundred people asked Krishnamurti his secret, the essence of his teaching. Speaking in a soft voice, his answer was, "I don't mind what happens." So simple, I thought, but not easy. Although I have a visa to the country of otherness, I don't live there. I keep returning to my familiar self, like a toddler keeps running back to her mother. I thought of our friend Clementine, who a few hours after escaping from the fire that destroyed her home, arrived at our house. "Everything is gone," she said, "even my favorite pair of red Dansko shoes, even my dark green leather motorcycle jacket, my new silk underwear, even the bank that was holding my safety deposit box with my jewelry and passport burned down." We cried about her house, the deer with a broken knee living under her deck, and the flock of quail she fed every day on her porch. "I don't think they made it to higher ground," she said tearfully. A few hours later, after drinking tea and wrapping ourselves in fuzzy blankets, I said, "It's probably true that everything is gone, but let's hold out for the possibility that your red Danskos are still there, on top of a heap of ashes." During the first week after the fire, Clementine was careful about not allowing her mind to wander to what she had lost or where she would live, or the fact that she didn't have insurance or savings enough to last long. She was awash in grief and gratitude for being alive and for the generosity of people she knew and strangers in stores. While shopping for socks in her favorite store, a stranger, upon hearing the story of the fire, bought Clementine a burgundy cashmere sweater, after which I told her that she should go shopping in Silicon Valley among the billionaires. "Someone might buy you a house," I said, "or a small island." Since she had nothing to lose, she had nothing to protect. It was like living with someone without skin, whose heart was cracked open, whose face was lit. If I don't think about what I lost, she said, nothing is missing. It seems that when you stop minding what isn't here, a friend, a house, a spouse, you can open yourself to what is. And when you do,